From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross, who's on assignment. On today's Fresh Air, writer and Fresh Air commentator Dagoberto Gilb. He's told us about life in his working-class Chicano community in El Paso, Texas, in his short stories and commentaries. His latest work is a novel based on some of the leaner years of his life when Gilb was living at the YMCA and getting by with low-paying odd jobs. Also, Coffee Talk, we discuss the brew with coffee expert Harvey Kravitz and coffee roaster Jack Treatman. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the return of Homicide, Life on the Street. All that coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava. In a speech to the Israeli Knesset in the past half hour, President Clinton praised Israel for signing the peace pact with Jordan yesterday. Repeating what he told Jordan's parliament then, Mr. Clinton said the forces of violence could not succeed. They are, the president said, the past, not the future.
After all the bloodshed and all your tears, you are now far closer to the day when the clash of arms is heard no more, and all the children of Abraham, the children of Isaac, the children of Ishmael, will live side by side in peace.
Israel has now made peace with two of its neighbors, Jordan and Egypt. This morning, Mr. Clinton was in Syria, another neighbor and a longtime foe of Israel's. He told the Israeli lawmakers that, quote, something was changing in Syria and that its leaders understood it was time to make peace. Mr. Clinton added that there would still be, in his words, a good deal of hard bargaining. Syrian leader Hafez al-Assad made clear earlier today that his country wants a total return of the Golan Heights, which are now under Israeli control. The Muslim-led government forces in Bosnia today closed in on a frontline town west of Sarajevo. That came a day after the government troops appeared to turn the tables in a major offensive against Serb forces in the northwestern part of the country. As Richard Carruthers reports from nearby Croatia, the Bosnian troops also captured a substantial amount of Serb military equipment.
A UN spokesman said the Bosnian army had punched out of the Muslim enclave of Bihać and captured up to 60 square miles. Bosnian Serb forces were caught unaware. Their command and control structure collapsed as they withdrew, forcing them to abandon tanks and artillery. The spokesman said it was a significant military operation, but we'll have to see if it can be sustained and what the Serb response is. While government soldiers celebrated on the streets of Bihać town, aid agencies reported several thousand Serb refugees were fleeing the area. Government forces have been probing front lines across Bosnia, with Serbs appearing overstretched and suffering from a Belgrade-imposed fuel blockade. However, a Bosnian army offensive on the Serb-held town of Doboj to the north appears to have failed, with reports of up to 200 Bosnian casualties. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
In Moscow today, the government of Boris Yeltsin survived a vote of no confidence. The opposition in the State Duma, or lower house of parliament, fell 33 votes shy of the 226 needed to pass the no-confidence motion. NBA owners and players have announced the professional basketball season will tip off as scheduled a week from tomorrow, and it would end without a work stoppage. Owners say they will not lock out players. Players have agreed not to strike as both sides work to negotiate a long-term agreement. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 23 points at 38.71 with a half hour to go in trading. This is NPR News. Procter & Gamble says it has sued Bankers Trust New York Corp. for at least $130 million. P&G claims that Bankers Trust did not fully lay out the terms and risks of a derivative investment it proposed to the Cincinnati-based manufacturer. Though the derivative investments were set up to hedge against risk, many derivative investors lost money this year when interest rates jumped. Procter & Gamble says it lost $102 million after ignoring its usual rules on investment risk. It is the second such suit brought against Bankers Trust. Attorney General Janet Reno says she is opposed to Proposition 187, a California ballot measure that would deny basic government services to illegal aliens. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Reno says she recognizes that illegal immigration is a problem, and she says the department has taken steps to address it by beefing up border patrols and increasing the number of people who are deported. But Reno says the California measure goes too far.
It doesn't make sense to turn school teachers and nurses into border patrol agents. It doesn't make sense to kick kids out of school or not to give them immunizations. When we look at what's happening in America today, we see the problems associated with neglect, and it doesn't serve any purpose.
Reno told reporters that even some supporters of Proposition 187 acknowledge some real concerns about the measure. She says her department is preparing an official report on whether it's constitutional. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The ballot measure has become a central point in California's gubernatorial and Senate races. Republican Senate challenger Michael Huffington, who supports the measure, confirms that his wife paid an illegal immigrant to be a nanny to their children for several years. The woman stopped working for the Huffingtons when he became a congressman a year and a half ago. And the Population Council today revealed that clinical trials have begun in the U.S. on the French abortion pill RU486. I'm Melinda Pencava, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. During the past year, Dagoberto Gilb has become one of the hot new writers to watch. His first book, a collection of stories called The Magic of Blood, was published last year. It won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award for First Fiction and was a finalist for the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award. Gilb also won a Whiting Writers Award. All this acclaim led to a contract with Grove Press and his first published novel. And you may have heard Gilb's occasional commentaries on Fresh Air. Though he's been writing for over a decade, for most of his adult life, Dagoberto Gilb supported himself by working as a construction worker and carpenter in El Paso, Texas, where he still lives. This current success is quite a contrast to Gilb's life when he first moved to El Paso in search of work. That period is the basis for his new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. Let's start with a reading.
Mickey said he checked into the Grand because he needed a place to stay cheap, and this downtown hotel seemed as good as any. But once he'd been there long enough that he almost didn't wince about the smell, he got afraid he might begin feeling so sorry he'd also have forgotten why and what he was doing there. So then he got scared he was going to find himself in another situation right when he didn't need it most. Anything might happen with the Alkies or Uglies, who liked yelling and fighting then spitting up or passing out on the corridor rug. Was Mickey the only one who noticed how it had been left there unvacuumed, not to mention unwashed, for so many years that a gooey, infertile mix of desert sand and cigarette ashes and whiskey and beer and blood and God knew what else had formed a topsoil? And Mickey was being stalked constantly by those winking and much too expensive bitches of questionable sex, swishing and waddling in and out of the conjoining rooms to copulate with men so sad that he couldn't calm his mind imagining what those groans and cries corresponded to. Mickey puffed up images of the future when that money came. Even a portion would be good enough. It was going to come because it had to and it was supposed to. He knew it. He believed. He had to believe because how could he not? Mickey entertained a whole range of potential fantasies. Faraway travels in jungles, on mountains, near oceans, knockout women who knew how to love. The most realistic was a car. At this loop in time, even an old car in its back seat where he might sleep to save a few dollars. It didn't even need to be that particularly clean. Anything that ran would do because this place, the hotel, was not an answer. Definitely not what he was looking for. Not what was necessary for this business of his. He had to have an address so he could be reached, and this hotel was not reliable. And he couldn't live on the streets, out in the open, where he might have to explain himself, what he was waiting for. And why should he have to? He was no bum or wino. He needed a place to hole up proper. He needed to concentrate and be careful.
That's Dagoberto Gilb reading from his new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. Well, Mickey does move into the YMCA in El Paso, Texas. Have you ever lived in a Y?
Yeah.
In El Paso, yeah. Texas?
Yes, I did. I lived there for more months than I kind of try to remember.
Well, how did you end up at the Y?
Well, it was kind of a bad time in my life, and I didn't have a lot of money, and much like Mickey, this story parallels a real life situation that I had. I had found myself with very little money, and no job, And I was living in hotels, and, you know, very inexpensive hotels, much like Mickey. And someday I met a woman that suggested that the Y was a good place to live. So I decided to do that.
And was it?
Well, you know, much like this, the story is about what it's like to live there. And at some point, you sort of start losing your ability to know what's real. And so the novel is much about, it's as much about living in a YMCA and living in that reality or non-reality, that delusional place that takes over one's mind when he or she lives in it.
And were most of the people at the Y, like you, down on their luck, in between jobs, waiting for something to happen?
Well, it's sort of, you know, I joke that the YMCA, the long-term residents, it's sort of the middle class of the down and out.
Yeah.
And so you're not quite on the streets, and you're not in a hotel anymore, but everybody there is, there's something, you're not there for good reasons. You're there for bad reasons, for something's wrong. Either that or you're old. There's also a retirement, kind of a level of people that are there for retirement reasons, if you can call it that. It's not a very good place to be in retirement, but.
Well, you write Mickey was good at poverty.
Uh-huh.
Were you good at poverty?
Yeah, I've always been pretty good at poverty. Still am, mostly.
What does that mean, though, to be good at poverty?
Well, like a lot of athletic skills, you're disciplined and you know how to control yourself, and you can you know, when you need to not eat, you don't eat. When you don't have any money, you have to make choices about what you're going to do with that money. And sometimes it's not food. Sometimes it's maybe I'm going to eat a candy bar today, so I'll spend 50 cents or, you know, I guess it's 79 nowadays. And that's what being skilled and adept at that is. You just make decisions. And in fact, a lot of guys that were there doing that. I mean, you just, sometimes you don't eat. You eat, maybe you try to figure out one day, one meal a day, and what it'll be.
What kind of jobs did you get?
Me? Yeah. Oh, I did all kinds of jobs. I mean, I did a lot of jobs.
Like?
I mean, 2-3 jobs. Tile, carpentry a lot. You know, there's a job in here. I had a couple of these jobs, you know. One time, this Mickey goes through this job that I had, actually, where a guy, I go out and pluck nails and put them in tin cans. It was the oddest job I've ever had, actually. I didn't have any sense of what I was doing this for. This guy had me taking nails out of old lumber and putting them in tin cans.
How long did that job last?
I did that for 2 days. Mickey only does it for a day. Actually, in the story, he's the guy. I had another job with the guy that I have Mickey working with. I did another job with this guy who had a fetish for Mexican women. But you know, I did that for 2 days because that's how long it lasted, and then it sort of ended.
So you have no idea what you were doing and why.
I got $2 an hour. It was under the minimum wage, and, you know, I'd gone out, and I just wanted the money. I said, it seemed like it was going to lead to something because it didn't make sense. And then the guy, when I was done with all the wood with all the nails in it, that was the end of it. It didn't make sense, never has. That's El Paso. El Paso's lots of things like this that don't make sense to me.
When did you first start writing?
Fiction.
Fiction.
I wrote a bad novel, like in the late 70s. I wrote a bad novel, which took me a few years to realize was bad. I thought it was a great novel. Probably is a great novel.
Well, who said it was so bad?
Well, now I do. But at the time, I'd sent it around and a couple agents. I remember this one agent, she said, some of this is just great and some of this is just awful. And I thought that, well, we can just reduce the awful proportion and just publish it. And the next book I'll have less awful and more good, you know. But unfortunately, that's not how it worked. But, you know, I just sort of started, thought you'd wrote novels. And I just what I wanted to do. I mean, for money, in fact. I thought you even got paid for it.
Well, you've learned the hard way that comes later, if you're lucky.
Yeah, kind of a lot later. And there's a whole lot of years between the later. You kind of forget that there's a lot of years.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Dagoberto Gilb, and he's a writer, a novelist. He has a first novel just been published called The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Dagoberto Gilb. Now, you grew up in L.A., is that right?
Right.
And your mother is Mexican-born?
Yes.
And your father of German descent?
Right. He grew up in Boyle Heights, which is East Los Angeles.
What kind of a neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up over, near Watts. It's now, there's a little junior college, near Western and Imperial is where I grew up. It's sort of mixed. It was mixed, maybe 25% Mexican-American, and mostly white. And then just across the street was totally black, It was the years when, we were the main thing on everybody's mind was race. L.A. is probably, in my opinion, is the most racist city I've ever known.
In what way? Yeah, in what way do you mean that?
I mean it just like it sounds. I think it's a very racist city. People are very racially conscious, and there's a lot of anger and different kinds of things going on. I've always been extremely sensitive about it. I'm a virulent anti-racist. I just get really upset about it because I grew up with so much of it.
So what kind of a kid were you?
I was more or less raised myself. My mom, divorced. I didn't even grow up with my dad. And so my mom was this very pretty woman who went out a lot and was, she went out a lot. And so I was left alone a lot. And so I always took care of myself. So I always had a lot of freedom to do anything I wanted. So I did anything I wanted.
Did you get in trouble?
There was no trouble to get into because nobody paid any attention. I could do anything I wanted. There was no place to go home. I used to, I remember when in high school at some point, I used to ditch a lot. And I got real good at my forging my mom's, name. And I got so good at it and so calm about it that one time I remember I had, wrote in my own handwriting and turned it in. And, I go to the vice principal's office. And I've been suspended enough times for varying things like fights or something. And my mother was there. And, it's kind of rare to see my mother. At the school, and I'm with this vice principal, and there's a stack of letters, that excused me for my absences and things. And on the top was the one I had just written in my own handwriting. Of course, underneath were all the letters I'd forged in my mother's handwriting.
So what was her reaction?
She looked and she defended me. Oh, yes, he was home. This is the great thing about my mother. She was just this, she always backed me. And of course, the other thing is that I wasn't really sure she knew if she didn't write those other notes because she was having her own troubles. I mean, she had her own troubles. So a lot of things, I don't know if she didn't notice or didn't want to or wasn't talking about that. She just sort of, as we walked out, she got, sort of her little mad. But she had her own, so many other troubles. This was pretty minor league to her.
So when you weren't in school, what did you do? How'd you occupy your time?
Oh, I'd ditch and go to the beach. I love to go to the beach. And sometimes I'd go to other places, I'd just ditch and go places.
And were you by yourself?
No, I had friends. My friends were mostly other kids that were from divorced homes. Mm-hmm. Those are my partner. Anybody that had parents were weird to me, because I could do anything I wanted. In fact, I used to be very intimidated by people that had a father. I didn't know what that was like. I didn't understand so, and I'd go visit people's homes. Of course, also, I was always the dirty kid.
What do you mean by that?
I was unclean. I remember when I was very young, there was this one boy's, mom. I'd come in, and this was at a young age. She used to come and scrub me. She'd think that I would come off or something. I was too dirty. Because I didn't, you know, I was always taking care of myself. But I also because in the neighborhood, you know, everybody knew that my mother was, you know, my mother was the Mexican woman. And that was like bad in the, I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, and my mom was the one over there, you know, and the attractive woman that went out with men and was divorced, and she was Mexican.
So you had, did you feel you had to live down her reputation?
Yeah, but also, you know, anybody that said anything, I'd kick their ass. Mm. And that was how it was. On the one hand, I could think and be upset with her as much as I wanted, but nobody could say it to me because I wouldn't let them.
After your parents divorced, did you have any relationship with your father?
Yeah, I never lived in my home, in a home, and he never lived with me. But by the time, I always saw him, like, you know, birthday, Christmas Eve, but, you know, it's sort of a distant thing, you know, it's sort of interesting to see him, but, you know, I knew him that way. But by the time I was 13, the great thing that he did, in Spanish, he'd be called El Mero Chingón.
Meaning?
The head dude, so to speak, at this plant where he worked. My mother grew up next door to this place, and he was the floor supervisor. He was this white guy that spoke Spanish. 75% of the people in this big industrial laundry spoke Spanish. The other 20% were blacks, and maybe 5% of the truck drivers were white guys. And my old man was the main guy. And anyway, by the time when I was 13, the one thing he did give me that I'm really grateful to is I could always get a job, and I worked 2, 3, 4 hours a day and made money. And that money mattered because, you know, it's how I sort of lived.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of you doing this construction work or carpentry work and how different that must be from sitting down and writing, especially writing fiction. How do you compare and contrast those two kinds of occupations?
Well, in the simplest way, in a lot of respects, it's similar because it's, you know, when people are seeing you guys work, they see the large of it. Really, when you're working, it's this one small thing after the one small thing to the next small thing. It's one nail after another. And it's very much like that with writing. It's one sentence after another. So you have to be as meticulous, and at least I feel I have to be as meticulous after each one. And I admire these people that say they write these huge drafts and they just go. And I can't do that. I have to write one paragraph at a time, and I can't go to the next one until I finish the last one. And so that's just how I go about it. And then to that extent, that's very much like what a carpenter has to do. You can't really kind of do this one sloppy and then move along. You can't do that.
But is there something even physical about writing for you?
Sometimes when I've been upset, it's very much like pounding nails. I've been the keyboard's not big enough and it's made of plastic. and I feel like, oh God, I'm going to break this sucker any minute now. I'm so mad. But they are different. Yeah. They're definitely different. But, you know, I guess I feel like, you know, my mental life or something, or whatever you call it, the artist, right? I feel a little awkward when I say artist.
You don't think you're an artist?
You know, I think, what a joke that is. But anyway, the artist in me, God, is that funny. But anyway, you know, likes that other thing. I mean, I like stories. I've always liked stories, and so I can't resist them. And it's sort of like getting into a good dream. When you're into a good story, it's like a good dream. And you just sort of lose yourself into the dream. And it's a, you know, as addictions go, it's a good one. It's not like, you know, drinking too much or smoking too much weed or heroin or something. It's writing. It's kind of a good kind. And you get into it and you sort of, you know, lose yourself. It kind of messes up your life if it's not going well. Mm-hmm. Because there you are. You're doing this again when you really should be working. You should really have a job.
So it doesn't feel quite like a job for you?
I try to pretend it is, but the thing is there's no paychecks. And also I'm like this bad boss. Sometimes I'm this good, you know, it's like I joke, you know, my German and Mexican, it's like this German guy's going, "Verk, verk."
And what's the other guy doing?
The other guy's kind of going, "Oh, man, lighten up. Let's have some fun today." And so it's always this conflicted, these two guys, you know, on each shoulder. This, you know.
Well, one of the things that I read about you is that you're a new voice, a voice for the Chicano people. What do you feel about that when you're described that way?
Yeah, I'm mixed, and if you get the entendre. I like it, and I'm proud of where I live, and you know, and where I come from. And I like it when it's meant well. I just came back from Yale University, and I spoke to a Chicano organization there, a group of Chicano students at Yale University. And I was extremely proud, mostly of them. I just felt so good to see them and what they were doing, and I was just like, my pride was just, you know, just, it was great. That sort of thing, when they like what I have to say, that sort of thing makes me feel good. Now, in other people, I sometimes feel like it's a way of diminishing what I'm doing, and I've always been sort of a construction worker, and I have an attitude, and I don't like it when they do that. And I say, wait a minute, how come I'm just not an American writer? I mean, why do I have to be a Chicano writer for you?
Well, you've written, too, about being hired to work on a show called Juarez, I guess. It was a TV show.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you came up against, and I guess it's this kind of Hollywood idea of Chicano life, which is that the plots had to do with bullfighting, tequila, whorehouses, and mariachi music. And that was the stereotype, the cliche, at least that show was dealing with.
Yeah, it was a funny one to me. They start off in this, there are these rich Mexican family, and they're down there in old Mexico, and they have bulls in their backyard, like we all do, you know. And they're bullfighting. In the evening, they go to a whorehouse, and they're doing their toros, you know. And, of course, it's in a, you know, I always visualize that the scene would be these beautiful Mexican women in these black brassieres. And anybody that's gone to a Mexican whorehouse knows that that isn't exactly what it looks like. But then the next scene, the funny thing is, so now there are these rich people in Mexico, and suddenly now they've moved to the Segundo Barrio in El Paso, which is the poorest part of town. Like, oh, you know, we're just going to move to the poorest part of town now. Like, they didn't know better, or who knew it, you know. But, you know, when I got it, I sort of said, well, you know, I know about as much of these people. You might as well have me write a show about Armenian people. I know that probably as well as these people. I've never known these kinds of people before.
Well, thank you very much, Dagoberto Gilb, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Dagoberto Gilb is a Fresh Air commentator and author of The Last Known Residents of Mickey Acuña. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coffee isn't just coffee anymore. It's now become the realm of the connoisseur. Coming up, we discuss the taste, the history, and the varieties of coffee with expert Harvey Kravitz and coffee roaster Jack Treatman. And TV critic David Bianculli is happy about the return of Homicide, but he wonders why some shows get more hype than others. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Penkava. President Clinton addressed the Israeli Knesset an hour ago, saying that Syrian leader Hafez al-Assad, a longtime foe of Israel, had begun to speak in a language of peace the Israelis could understand. Mr. Clinton, who met with Assad in Damascus before flying to Israel today, said something was changing in Syria and that its leaders understood it was time to make peace. Mr. Clinton also said the U.S. would stand by Israel.
Until we achieve a comprehensive peace in the Middle East, and then after we achieve comprehensive peace in the Middle East, know this, your journey is our journey, and America will stand with you.
Mr. Clinton said that between Israel and Syria, there was still, in his words, a lot of hard bargaining to do. In particular, Syria wants a full pullout of Israeli troops from the Golan Heights, which were seized by Israel during the 1967 war. Israel wants guarantees before agreeing to a full withdrawal. The Population Council revealed today that U.S. clinical tests of the French abortion pill RU486 began last month at more than a dozen abortion clinics. In the face of fierce opposition of the pill from anti-abortion groups, the Population Council said it would not reveal where the tests were taking place. The study aims to determine how safe and effective RU486 is when given to women in the first 2 months of pregnancy. One doctor with the Population Council says women who go to some abortion clinics for surgical abortions are being offered this option as part of the study. Russian President Boris Yeltsin's government survived a no-confidence motion today. But as NPR's Anne Gerrels reports, the battle is far from over.
The opposition needed 226 votes to pass the no-confidence motion, but only 193 deputies voted in favor. Yet if the government takes that as a vote of approval, parliamentarians say it would be mistaken. In part, members voted to keep the government, saying, "Better the devil you know." Opposition to the government is growing. Communists say Yeltsin is killing industry. Reformers say Yeltsin isn't doing enough to kill off inefficient plants. Prime Minister Chernomyrdin unveiled a tough budget for 1995 today, but reformers wonder whether he and the president will really fight for it. In a nod to opponents, President Yeltsin appointed a new agriculture minister from the ranks of the opposition Agrarian Party. This is hardly enough to stem criticism of the government, and it's unlikely to help the agricultural sector, which of all the areas of the economy is in the most trouble. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
Haiti's commerce minister says local and state elections planned for December will likely be put off until January. Louis Dujois, who heads the centrist PEN party, said today there would be no time to plan for the balloting. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rising 26.92 points to close at 38.75. This is NPR News. Many commercial fishermen in Massachusetts are furious with a ruling this morning that restricts the use of small mesh nets in the Georges Bank for the next 3 months. The Federal Fisheries Council in Danvers, Massachusetts, says it has taken that action because the once rich waters have been overfished. The council was still meeting today and has another proposal in the works to close Georges Bank to those who fish for flounder, cod, haddock, and some of the other depleted stocks. Commerce Secretary Ron Brown would have to sign off on that for it to go into effect. South Korea's opposition has introduced a no-confidence motion against the prime minister and his entire cabinet in connection with the bridge collapse in Seoul last week that killed 32 people. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Prime Minister Lee Jong-duk offered his resignation over the bridge disaster last week, but President Kim Yong-sam refused to accept it. Instead, Mr. Kim fired the mayor of Seoul and took to the airwaves in a nationally televised address to accept responsibility for the tragedy. But for many, the bridge incident has become a grisly symbol of government mismanagement, and even a presidential apology has failed to calm the public outcry the collapse has touched off. The no-confidence motion demands the dismissal of Prime Minister Lee and his entire cabinet. The opposition holds only 110 of the 299 seats in Parliament. While it is unlikely to muster a majority needed to win the motion, the very fact there will be a vote at all tomorrow is an embarrassment for the government. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
A UN study out today says that biopiracy is cheating developing countries out of more than $5 billion a year. According to the UN study, the pirates are multinational food and drug companies that do not compensate developing countries for the plants and bacteria and fungus they use to make products and develop drugs. The authors of the study do allow that, on the other hand, third world countries pirate agricultural chemicals and drug compounds made by developed nations. I'm Melinda Penkava, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A recent report published in the Journal of the American Medical Association said caffeine is the world's most widely used mind-altering drug. If you look at the number of coffee bars and specialty coffee houses cropping up across the country, it's clear Americans are drinking lots of expensive coffee. Like other cities, my city, Philadelphia, is enjoying a coffee renaissance. One of the older, more established shops is Old City Coffee, located on a quiet side street not far from the Liberty Bell. I spoke with coffee roaster Jack Treatment, the co-proprietor of Old City, and with coffee expert Harvey Kravitz about why we love this drink so much.
Coffee consumption reached a peak in 1962. There were more coffee drinkers in 1962 than any time in the country's history. And about that same time, maybe a few years earlier, large roasters started tinkering with the percentage of Robusta beans to Arabican beans. Mm. Arabican beans being the harder type to grow, grown at much higher altitude and rich soil conditions, and that's the real coffee. Robusta is much more abundant, easier to grow, much cheaper. And our country has a really rich coffee heritage, but a lot of it's before the Second World War. And there were many regional coffee roasters throughout the country, just as there were regional beer brewers and things along those lines, part of the food chain.
Well, you mentioned the word beans, and I would actually like to talk about what people should look for when looking for a bean.
Fresh.
But how do you know it's fresh?
It's a great question. That's one of the things that that I'm really fussy about is freshness. And because basically coffee, after it's roasted, is good for 7-10 days. It's not going to last longer than that unless you airtight and freeze it. Coffee just is extremely perishable. So all of those bean purveyors you see in supermarkets where the turnover is relatively questionable, you don't know how fresh they are, but there is one great test, and I call it the nose test.
As simple as that.
You stick your nose in those beans, and you will know if they are fresh. If there's any question, when in doubt, go without.
Why? Because it will smell
I brought a sample of freshly roasted beans. When you open that jar, mm-hmm. There's no question about the freshness. I mean, you know. If those beans were left open for a week and then you smell them, they would not have that fragrance, that aroma. It would be missing.
Jack, let me ask you, because I know that I've seen shiny beans, I've seen dull-looking beans, I've seen various color beans. For instance, we have some very
like a medium
brown
roast,
and then we have some nearly green, sort of pale-looking beans.
Well, the green beans on the right are unroasted beans. Now, they are processed beans. Coffee is actually a cherry that grows on a tree or a bush. Cherries are then pulped.
Cherries?
Coffee
looks like a cherry.
Okay. It's bright red.
Bright red cherry, yeah.
If you saw coffee growing, you would not recognize it because it's totally different. The coffee bean that you actually purchase is the seed of the cherry. Hmm. It's dried, pulped, and then roasted, just as nuts or things along those lines. There are usually two beans per cherry. In the case of pea berries, they're one. If you ever hear the term pea berry coffee, it's a very intense brew because there's only one seed per berry.
What about the difference between a shiny bean and a dull-looking bean?
Oh, I'm sorry, I got sidetracked.
Right. Okay,
when
Jack.
Coffee is roasted, you take this green processed bean. It can be a washed or semi-washed bean. Heat is applied, and roast means an intense blast of heat. It's not baked. The objective is, and this is controversial, there's no right or wrong. In Italy, they roast coffee by fire, and it's a very slow process. But the term roasting is a culinary term, means a very quick blast of heat in and out, and then you're done. A typical roast of 26 pounds of coffee for us is about 17 minutes. Mm. That's the difference between that's what the term roasting means. And there's a chemical transformation, and it goes through a process called pyrolysis, where it is chemically altered. That is why a unroasted bean you cannot brew.
And it has no fragrance at all. It smells green.
It can smell yeah. fruity. You yeah. can detect yeah. nuances between unroasted coffees. The darker the coffee is roasted, the more oil is released. So when you refer to a shiny bean, that yes. is a dark roasted coffee.
Okay.
That is sometimes called an Italian roast or French roast. But the essential oils are released, and there are many different roast colors. In our industry, we have no official standards. What is full city roast? What is medium? What's Italian? Our trade association is working on that right now.
Yeah, they've been offering color tiles for the roasters, and they've been promising it for, years now, and they still haven't offered them.
Well, is there a danger of taking the art away from it if you have to meet this kind of visual standard?
That too, is a very good question, actually.
Great question.
Yeah,
I think we're in an unregulated industry, which is,
is that good and bad, probably?
I think it's been bad in the past because you could serve anything, call it whatever you want,
right.
and no one could call you on it. I think it's good that standards of quality are being established, and there will be a shakeup in town because some people don't do such a great job.
Yeah, huh. Roasting coffee is in fact the real art. What's interesting is that the one thing us people who are into gourmet or specialty coffees, we get a little high-headed sometimes and look down our noses at the Maxwell Houses and Folgers of the world, but they deserve credit for one thing, and probably one thing only, and that's an incredible consistency of taste and roast, which is anyone who's done any roasting knows how difficult it is to produce that kind of consistency. The thing I've discovered, which I think is interesting relative to the question, is because I experiment roasting at home with a sample roaster, is that the same bean from batch to batch will require a slightly different roast for its optimum flavor, and it varies from bean to bean. For an example, I'll take a bean and roast what looks to be a medium dark, a little lighter than I might normally roast it, and it'll taste darker.
And that's
the kind of thing that very few people will ever pick up unless they really experiment with coffees. And the roaster retailers, some of them understand that and some of them don't. And the ones that do, I can spot it in their coffee immediately when I taste them.
Let me ask you about flavored beans, because I know the other thing you can see, you're making a face at me, Harvey. You can go to the supermarket and you see amaretto and vanilla, and you're rolling your eyes at me, Jack.
We sell flavored coffee.
You have to sell flavored coffee. There's demand for it.
How does that happen? And is it a matter of
well, you can be a snob and say, absolutely, we will not be involved with it. It's not real coffee. There are some high-quality flavoring extracts that use mostly natural ingredients, and it's an organic base, like an ethyl, an alcohol base. So it's nothing different than vanilla extract, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's added to the beans after it's roasted.
Right. Coffee's porous, so it absorbs the flavor. When you brew the coffee, you can taste the flavor. If you're drinking very high-quality coffee, it has so much nuance and delicacy on its own, I don't think it needs flavor enhancement.
Yeah, that's why we turn our nose up. You know, the funny thing, the specialty industry is in some way very grateful for the advent of flavors. They make a lot of fun of us on the West Coast because, you know, they think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But when you're in the business of selling coffee and flavors are selling, I mean, you can't argue, and it's been a boon to sales. The flavored coffees have been a tremendous boon to sales.
Let me ask you, Harvey, about if there are major differences between beans grown in Kenya, beans grown in Hawaii, Jamaica, Colombia, I know, and the choices are going on and on.
There's a lot of different characters that's recognizable in the different coffees grown in different areas. Coffee is grown all around the world, around the equator, 14 degrees north and south of the equator, at high altitudes, and most of those high altitudes are on volcanic slopes where the soil drainage is excellent. Their temperatures during the day are high, and your nights are cool, and you get a tremendous amount of rain, which is required for coffee. But it is amazing that all of these countries that grow coffee, people, I love Kenyan coffee. The fact of the matter is that every one of these coffee-growing countries grows coffee that is junk and coffee that is great. And anyone who says, I love it, I mean, they really aren't aware of the tremendous variation that you will get within a country and within regions. Mexican coffee, for an example, has a reputation of being a high aromatic coffee and low flavor and body. Yet in Mexico, some of the greatest beans in the world are grown out of certain areas. And that's true of most, and true of Colombia. Mm. I mean, Colombian beans used to be great. And there were coffees out of Colombia to knock your socks off. And today it's a very mediocre coffee.
More about coffee after this short break. My guests are coffee roaster Jack Treatment and coffee expert Harvey Kravitz. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our discussion about coffee. I asked Harvey Kravitz about how to store coffee beans.
Everyone talks about freezing coffee, which in fact will keep fresh coffee a long time, providing, one, it's kept in an airtight container. People too oftentimes will keep their beans in a paper bag in the freezer, and it just won't work. Because the major problem with freezing, that no one really seems to want to convey at times, is that even in an airtight container in the freezer, every time you take it out, you get a tremendous amount of condensation on those beans, which actually really deteriorates them very rapidly. And nobody tells you that very often.
But you need to let them defrost, so to speak.
Before you open, let the air condense the moisture on them. That moisture is a killer. It's like the oxidation that Jack referred to is what destroys the delicate oils in roasted coffee. And the air and the moisture just ruin them quick as could be.
So for people like me that keep my coffee in a little bag out on my counter.
Put them in a jar.
Put them in the jar in the freezer. Let me throw a question to you, Jack, about the grinding coffee. If people who have their own little grinder at home should do or not do anything,
well,
what should they know?
The maximum brew time is 5 minutes. Anything over 5 minutes, you're over-extracting coffee, which means you're going to be tasting the undesirable characteristics of coffee. So that's the golden rule. If it mm-hmm. takes longer than 5 minutes to brew, you need a coarser grind, because the coarser the grind, the faster it will brew. Water will pass through faster if
because there's more space between the grind.
The finer you get, you get more toward like a powder. Turkish coffee is a powder mm-hmm. Where you actually drink the grounds. So that's the golden rule. If you have the patience to wait 5 minutes and a fairly fine grind takes less than 5 minutes, I think you'll get more extraction per cup if you go off a finer ground.
But are you drip proponents as opposed to, I don't know if people percolate coffee anymore.
Perking is ancient history.
Went out
history.
With the 50s or something?
No one perks
never
coffee
boil.
Today.
Don't boil.
Don't boil. And that's
except
boil.
If you're camping. Cowboy coffee's fine.
Right. I've had cowboy coffee. It's quite extraordinary. Let me ask you, Harvey, sort of like people who become an expert in wine, they develop this kind of arsenal of adjectives to be able to describe all the various bottles of wine they've ever consumed in their life. When you get good with coffee, do you also get the language that goes along with
it? Well, you know, the language for cupping coffee in the vocabulary for tastes are extremely elusive to the public. One in particular that the cuppers have used and people in coffee understand is acidy, acidic. And it is, in the coffee lingo, is a real positive quality, but you can't transfer that to the public because the public, anything that tastes acid.
We say verve.
Yeah.
Verve instead of acid.
any euphemism. And the other curious thing about American palates and maybe laymen in general is that anything that isn't to their liking is, quote, bitter. Everything is bitter. If they don't like it, it's bitter. And the irony, of course, is that coffee, the general flavor category of coffee, is in fact bitter. And the bitterer the better, for the most part. But there are a number of things. And if we need to convey anything to our coffee-consuming public out there today, when they make their coffee, just try making it a little stronger. And instead of the trick is to make it strong and dilute it to taste. This eliminates the over-extraction problem that is so prevalent. Just make it stronger, try it stronger, and dilute it to taste, and you'll see a big difference.
So you mean after you've made your cup of coffee,
make
it seems a little too strong, just add a little bit of water?
Instead of running the water through the coffee, add it to the brewed coffee.
It's easy to fix coffee that's brewed too strong, but once it's too weak, you have to throw it out.
It's hard to make it stronger after you've made it.
And that's what I tell customers in the store. We, in the store, brew coffee very, very intensely, and some people just can't handle it, but it's a very simple matter. Just
add a little water. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't have to go through the coffee.
And there's nothing wrong with it. You're the person drinking it, and you're the one who has to enjoy it.
Absolutely.
Harvey Kravitz is a coffee expert. Jack Treatman is co-proprietor of Old City Coffee, located in Philadelphia.
People, I say it's so early in the morning. Ooh, it's a quarter till three. We're sitting here talking over cigarettes and drinking coffee. I'd like to show you where I've known nothing but good old joy since I met you, darling. Honey, since I met you, baby, yeah. I would love to have another drink of coffee now. Darling, help me smoke just one more cigarette now. I don't want no cream and sugar, 'cause I got you now, darling. But just let me enjoy, help me to enjoy this good time that we'll have, me. It's so early in the morning.
That's Otis Redding, recorded in 1966. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today, more on the president's trip to the Middle East, especially his decision not to visit the old city of Jerusalem. We'll hear about that, also a reaction to this week's events from Syria. Also on today's program, news of Mario Cuomo's very difficult re-election race. He's running for a fourth term as governor of New York State against State Senator George Pataki. Also, news of all the referenda that are on the ballot this November, and a story about why doctors are so reluctant to prescribe narcotics for patients who are suffering terrible pain.
Robert, thanks a lot. Those stories later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week's issue of Newsweek features a cover story on the NBC medical show ER, with a piece about how television dramas may be coming back as a result. TV critic David Biancooley gets Newsweek, but he doesn't get the point.
Look, ER is a good series. So is NYPD Blue, the only other TV drama to get as much hype this season. And both of them were in the top 10 last week, so they're some of the most popular shows on television. But was ER worthy of the cover of Newsweek? No. Did NYPD Blue deserve to monopolize the Emmy nominations for Best Written Drama Series last season? No. Yes, ER and NYPD Blue are runaway hits and deserve all the viewers they get. But part of the reason they get so many viewers is that they follow some of TV's other mega hits. ER is on NBC a half hour after Seinfeld, and NYPD Blue comes directly after Home Improvement and Grace Under Fire, the two most popular programs on television. But Chicago Hope, which airs opposite Seinfeld on CBS, has turned into a better medical show than ER. And so far this season, NYPD Blue has had its clock cleaned by Homicide: Life on the Street on NBC. Not in the ratings, but in terms of quality. The departure of David Caruso on next week's NYPD Blue may get all the attention, and ER may get all the magazine covers, but Homicide is better TV. It even began its current season by having its night shift detectives watching and discussing a particularly steamy TV cop show.
It's gratuitous. Gratuitous sex is disgusting.
There's no such thing as gratuitous sex. Gratuitous violence, yes, all violence is gratuitous, but sex cannot and will not ever be gratuitous.
They make them do that, you know.
Who makes who do what?
The networks make the writers and the producers add sex.
Well, I thought the networks, you know, were making the producers take the sex out. I mean, the producers and the writers, they put all that sex in there. Then the network cuts it out.
No, that's nudity. The network takes out the nudity, but they add sex.
How can you have sex without nudity?
Come on, big man, use your imagination.
That led to a rant by one cop, played by Richard Belzer, which prompted a weary response by another cop, played by Ned Beatty.
Hey, can you switch that channel off?
All they got on here is sitcoms and news magazines.
Now, yes, but soon, very soon, there's going to be like 500 channels. Besides the sports channel, the weather channel, there'll be the ballet channel, the dog food channel, the old Dreidel network. There won't be any books or newspapers, no telephones. We'll only be able to communicate with email and QVC. We'll all be interactive. All you need to see and hear, you'll see and hear without ever having to rise from your Sealy Posturepedic. I'm talking about high definition. I'm talking about virtual reality. I'm talking about living in the fast lane, the electronic information superhighway. Better get ready, because it's coming.
I wish they'd bring back Hawaii 5-0.
That's great writing. Homicide, I mean, not Hawaii 5-0. And Homicide is just as good at the drama. If you like the realistic feel and fast pace of ER, think of Homicide as ER times 10. But not only does Homicide appear on Fridays after a low-rated Dateline NBC, but it's directly opposite Picket Fences, another terrific show that's better than ER or NYPD Blue. Like Homicide, it has an astounding cast and some truly challenging plots. In this week's Picket Fences, for example, Kathy Baker, as the temporary mayor, addresses the town council with a very timely issue, one that she sees as having a connection with the town's current racial divisions over forced busing.
Last night, my sons came downstairs in their Halloween costumes, dressed as the Menendez brothers. Now, after reprimanding them, we found out that their original idea for costumes was O.J. and Nicole Simpson. Now, I mention this because the reason they decided not to be O.J. and Nicole is because they were aware of at least 20 other kids with the same plan.
My daughter.
Aside from the obvious bad taste, this poses a particular problem for us. The victim is a white woman and the alleged killer is a black man. We don't need that right now.
Until the networks wise up and move Picket Fences and Homicide away from one another, viewers have to either use a VCR or make a choice. If you have to choose, I'd recommend watching Homicide now, because it's on shakier ground. Picket Fences, at least, is sure to be around in reruns. But with either show, you can't lose, even if they don't dominate talk shows and magazine covers.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News and the author of Teleliteracy. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Kathy Wolfe and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Trick or Treat, we go deep into our vaults for our Halloween Archives edition and revive our expert on the undead, Dracula aficionado Raymond McNally. Also, we speak with movie gourmeisters John Carpenter and Tom Savini. I hope you'll join us for the next ghoulish edition of Fresh Air.